Right, morning, folks. So, I'll read the passage. We're starting, over the next 12 weeks or so, we're going to do the first half of Exodus. As you may know, if you've been around for long enough, like to mix it up, a bit of Old Testament, a bit of New Testament. So we're going to, look at that first half of Exodus, so for the next little period. So it's second book of the Bible, as you probably know, those first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, together known as the Pentateuch, and more likely than not written by Moses sometime across that period as the people of Israel, once they'd left Egypt and before they get into the Promised Land, obviously because Moses doesn't actually make it in there. Genesis, obviously, all the events there predate Moses' life, so recording what was probably an oral, just a spoken tradition up to that point. But then the other four are all things that are happening within his lifetime. Why Exodus? That whole sort of Exodus event is a huge landmark in the history of the people of Israel, and that was Jesus' own worldly history and inheritance. And so a big part of of God's work through the whole of history, if you look through the whole of the Bible, of God's story with his people, and pick out some of the sort of real highlights, you might think, creation and Eden, and then the calling of Abraham, and then Exodus, which is kind of really creating the people of Israel. Maybe King David's another high point. There's then all the stuff about the restoration of Jerusalem and the temple, and then Jesus, obviously, sitting really at the heart of our understanding of Bible, and then leading into church and ultimately Jesus' return. So it's a big thing in thinking like Jesus and trying to get insight, I guess, into what God's doing and how he's doing it. So what I'll do is I'll read it in sections and then we'll kind of reflect on those bits. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. And incidentally, these are broken down. Well, the first... Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, they're all Leah's children. Benjamin and Joseph are Rachel's children. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, they're children of the servants of Leah and Rachel. And so in some ways, the story of Israel in Egypt obviously starts well, think at least of averting the famine and his family being welcomed, although even then, obviously, Joseph's first experience in Egypt is many years in slavery and servitude. And then Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful, multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous, the land was filled with them. And by the time we get to the Exodus, then the numbers reckons, so the biblical account says about 600,000 men of fighting age. So if you round that up, there's probably a couple of million Israelites by the time they actually leave the country. Total population of Egypt, maybe 4 to 7 million. They're a very, very large minority within the nation of Israel. A little bit smaller probably at this point, because it does take a while from this point to the actual Exodus. So then comes a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing. Came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. We must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. So there we encounter the Israelites, enslaved as this large minority population within Egypt, and continuing, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but in some way continuing Joseph's project of kind of national resilience. And I guess an obvious thing to reflect on is, well, what's it like to be a slave? And, you know, as we'll see later on in Exodus and also Deuteronomy and other parts of the Old Testament, quite often God reminds the Israelites, you were slaves, you know, do this. Remember what it was like to be a slave. You know, for example, all of the rules against other Israelites holding Israelites as slaves. So this experience of slavery, unfortunately, I guess, for us, that the Egyptian form of slavery is a long way away, but we have other forms of slavery and even Christian sanctioned slavery much closer to our present. Think of the slave trade, in which obviously our country played quite a large part. So thinking about that, or the Israelites, I mean, what does it mean to be a slave? I mean, you could break it down lots of different ways. In some situations, it means it's rooted in literally a different legal status. You know, one is not a person anymore, one is a piece of property who can be bought and sold. But then in practically, you know, think of some of the things, the ways that manifest, that one is controlled, one may be subject often to physical violence and restrained, one may be or feel trapped, one may be hungry, thirsty, tired, and one's labour doesn't benefit oneself, it's for someone else's benefit. And I'm sure you could add other things to that as well. I imagine most of you would be aware, certainly if you're working in any large organisation, in recent years the UK government has introduced legislation around modern slavery. And what is modern slavery? Well, essentially, you don't have to be legally owned to effectively be a slave. And if you look across the world today, there are many, many millions of people whose life circumstances make them effectively slaves, even if they don't have that legal status. So, for example, there is someone, probably an indentured labourer, building bricks in India. And obviously we get examples, even in our own country, of people trafficked and held in ineffective slavery. So one question which I guess we should all reflect on is whether we're actually complicit in that. And, you know, for those who do, you know, look at things like ethical shopping, then as well as environmental issues, you can find out quite a lot of information about the sort of the employment practices and the supply chains that sit behind the things that we buy, the things that we consume. That idea of slavery, so, you know, there's one direct application. I guess another facet of it would be to ask, you know, are there senses in which we're slaves as well? And I guess for most of us, we're not constrained as directly as some of the people we thought about a moment ago. But thinking about those elements, well, I guess addiction as an obvious thing that leaves someone in a situation very close to slavery. Some people, to some extent, are slaves of their own history or the image that they try to maintain or present about themselves. It feels, you know, some of us may feel to some extent enslaved by entertainment and distraction. I guess that's part of the thinking around things like smartphone bans for children. You know, is it kind of, is it something, are we slaves to the devices in our pockets? Or, of course, as Jesus said, truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. So something about sin and a lack of God orientation. Says a second point to reflect on how, you know, how close we are to this situation of the Israelites at this early point in the Exodus story. So I'll read the next bit and then we'll sort of come back to that in a way. So the more they were oppressed, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, getting up towards this 2 million population. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly, made their lives bitter with harsh labour in brick and mortar and all kinds of work in the fields. And in their harsh labour, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So you get a little bit of insight, at least in that situation, about what actually drives exploitation and oppression. And I guess there's a mixture of fear. You know, they're afraid of them. There are so many of them. We saw a few verses ago, part of that fear is that they'll become an opposing military force if there's a regional conflict, but also a fear that they'll leave. You know, there's an enormous slave labor base providing, you know, agricultural, you know, all the kind of agriculture, presumably, comparatively, the ethnic Egyptians are having a better life because of all of the slave labor of the Israelite population. And then that's combined with, you know, you're different to us. They're a distinct population. They have distinct practices. And inevitably, we all find reasons to justify ourselves, to see our own views as right, appropriate, and reasonable. Or, you know, break it down a different way. Perhaps you think about some of our contemporary situations. Often it starts with fear or distance. And even if we don't actually fear someone, if we don't know anything about them, then that can be a foundation on which we can view them as other and different. And if we throw into the mix some level of some reason to have self-interest, something that we gain by viewing other people as different or other, then we can get to the point where we can convince ourselves that we are really different and special, and, you know, they really deserve to be in this situation, which is actually exploitation. So, moving on again, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you're helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see the baby's a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live. Obviously, with so many people, they probably weren't the only midwives, but, you know, maybe these are the head midwives in the Jewish population. So perhaps not quite this sort of traitor, but Pharaoh is trying to co-opt the midwives to his own agenda. He wants them to betray their own people and support his particular agenda. And what's his agenda? Get rid of the boys. Why boys? Well, I guess most obviously it's going to be that sort of military risk, I guess, is in his mind here. He's happy to have the labourers, but he doesn't want the people who are potentially going to provide part of a standing army against him. The midwives, however, feared God and didn't do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. So I think the midwives, they're present a really interesting example of non-violent resistance. So Pharaoh says, okay, you know, I want you to kill the boys, and they refuse. And I guess you'd probably guess this is Gandhi. If you think of the recent history of non-violent resistance and political change, I guess Gandhi is the most important figure you would look to, and then the civil rights movement in the US and the end of apartheid. There've been a whole bunch of places where non-violent resistance has been really important, even in modern history. So I guess most of us don't need to don't face such explicit dilemmas. We're not often, you know, explicitly told to do things that we think are clearly wrong. But, you know, another thing that I thought, you know, was worth reflecting on is whether and what things we do sometimes need to resist. And I guess, you know, here the allusion is to matters of culture. You know, the common expectations about how things are where we are and with the people that we spend time with and in the places that we study and work or socialise, that there may be all sorts of expectations and things that are normal that are not God things and that need to be resisted, perhaps, much as the midwives refused to comply with Pharaoh's directives. So what happens next? The king of Egypt summons the midwives and asks them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" And the midwives answer Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive," which is almost certainly a lie. But nonetheless, that's what they did. And it's a brief ethical digression here. Is it wrong to lie? Was it kind of okay for the midwives to lie or not? And depending on, you know, how you understand ethics and responsibility, different people kind of actually come to different decisions about that. So I just thought I'd remind us of, you know, some of the things that we were looking at over the last couple of years. People who struggle with the idea of them lying in that situation often do so because they want a world where you can apply simple rules all the time with no exceptions. And unfortunately, the world isn't like that. And indeed, what it means to follow God, we were suggesting before when we look at Romans and so on, we may end up with things that are usually the right thing to do, like telling the truth. But actually what's driving our decision-making is trying to worship and follow God. And when God is our reference point, and then from God we get values and principles like respect for life, for example, and then those can express themselves in particular situations and particular ways of doing things. So there was a slightly opportune digression anyway. So God was kind to the midwives, so God was happy that they were lying to Pharaoh as well, so it's all right. And the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own, and Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: every Hebrew boy that's born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So that sort of begs a question. Does non-violence work? Well, it more or less did in the case of British rule in India, and it more or less did in the case of the civil rights movement. But to be honest, I think the only reason that it did work, you know, why did it work in India? Because the British Empire claimed the moral high ground. You know, they claim to be living out a Christian ethic, you know, and the non-violent resistance that they encountered and the military response that the British Empire initially attempted left them in a situation where eventually no one could really pretend that this could be the right thing anymore, that this could be the Christian thing anymore. So there are definitely situations in the world today where non-violence will not work in the sense of it will not provide a political resolution. Because if the oppressor has no shame, then it won't necessarily change things. But then that does kind of beg the question, should non-violence work? Is that the point of non-violence? Is the point of non-violence to achieve change in the world? And our example clearly is Jesus, who in going to the cross demonstrates repeatedly that non-violent response, and in worldly terms, fails completely. But ultimately, we trust that God has and does, through that, done something remarkable, although we're still waiting to see it fully bear fruit. Of course, what Pharaoh does, because he is no respecter of God or Christian values, is to escalate the situation. So since the midwives won't come on side, it now becomes the job of everybody to oppress the Hebrew people. And too often today, that's the same. You know, situations of oppression lead to more oppression, lead to more oppression. And it's very, very difficult to do that non-violent thing, to find ways of diffusing these situations of conflict and oppression. But of course, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. So that's where we find the Israelites, God's people, at the beginning of Exodus, in this appalling situation, which unfortunately is also echoed around the world today. But we know, having read to the end of the book, both literally, metaphorically, that God's purpose, God's journey, the trajectory through the whole of the Bible is again and again from slavery to freedom. And that's part of our Christian hope as well, that a big part of what Jesus has and done and is doing is release from slavery and bringing us into the freedom of sonship, daughtership. But things we might think about along the way, just recapping those points of reflection, which I've also shared on the WhatsApp. Are we complicit in exploitation and oppression today? Are we slaves in practice, if not in the letter of the law? And are there things that we should be non-violently resisting in our situations as we find ourselves today, like those midwives did, who are really, if you like, the hero of this first chapter of Exodus?